to this historic moment we have finally, and this is an opportunity essentially for us to deepen our understanding of the dynamics in our movement. We have two very well-known spokespeople, Dr. Gary Francione and Bruce Friedrich, both of whom I've known. Yes, give them a big hand. I've known both of these fine people for many years, and it's really an honor to be able to be participating in this together. And I want to remind everyone that this is your opportunity also to ask questions. So we're going to have basically two 10-minute opening statements, one from each person, first from Bruce and then from Gary. And then there's going to be an opportunity for Q&A. So you can, we have a microphone here. And where else? Is that the only one? And then we have a handheld. So if you can't get up here, but otherwise you can come up here. We have a handheld. Somebody will run it around to you. And then we'll have closing statements of about 2 minutes each at the end. So the basic idea, that the title of this is What About Welfare Reforms? I should maybe introduce myself before we get started. My name is Dr. Will Tuttle, and I'm the author of The World Peace Diet. And thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you. I've been a vegan and activist for about 33 years. And the basic idea here is that even though we inhabit, we feel one movement, there's an awful lot of disagreement about the tactics that we use in terms of working with industry or not, and so forth. So this is a chance for us to dive more deeply into these questions. And this is what I was given to read, so I'm going to read this. The choice of abolition or welfare strategies has become very contentious, particularly in pursuit of liberating animals used for food. Because this is an animal rights conference and the most basic right of any living being is the right to life, we must assume that we all share the vision of a world where animals are no longer being used or killed for human gain. And I know you both affirm that idea, obviously. And so I'd like to, I'll just continue with this. To enrich the discussion, we have asked two panelists with contrasting views on the merits of welfare reforms to define the preferred strategy to tell us why it is most likely or most effective in advancing us toward the vision of animal liberation and whether the two strategies are compatible. Following their presentations, we will open the room to 20 to 25 minutes of audience participation before allowing for a 2-minute closing statement. So I'll just say briefly, we have, as I said, Bruce Friedrich and Gary Francione. Bruce was the vice president for campaigns for PETA for 15 years. He is now serving at Farm Sanctuary for the last couple of years as director of advocacy, senior director of advocacy, and he's been a vegan, in his words, a vegan abolitionist for 25 years. And we have also with us Dr. Gary Francione, the distinguished professor of law at Rutgers University, author of quite a few books, author of Animals, Property, and the Law, Rain Without Thunder, The Animal Rights Debate, and the new book, Eat Like You Care. So, without any further ado, I'd like to give a hand for Bruce Friedrich. He'll be beginning our presentation.
Did I say it wrong?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Wow. No, I just made a mistake. Since Bruce had his thing up here, I got distracted. It's actually the agreement was, we should take this down, I guess, is that Gary actually will go first. And then Bruce. So let's give a hand for Gary Francione.
Bruce, do you want to go first?
Bruce, do you mind if I sort of get this welfare stuff? All right.
We can probably move it.
When?
Oh, here's a cordless if you want to steal the
button. Oh, okay. Wait, let me use that. When Alex Hirschaft asked me to do this, he asked me to do like this session this morning, and then he said we would have a more sort of intimate, depends on what your idea of intimacy is, I guess, but we would have a more intimate get-together. So I was expecting a slightly different thing. If I knew we were going to have these people, I would have done the second PowerPoint presentation I've ever done in my life. But you ain't getting that because I don't have it. You're just going to have to deal with me. The bottom line is, look, as I said this morning when I started off, I disagree very, very much with what's going on in this movement. But as with Bruce and other people here who promote a welfarist or regulationist sort of agenda, I have no doubt that they're doing this because they sincerely believe it's right, and I don't in any way question their integrity. I do, however, think they are incorrect and they're pushing this movement in the wrong direction. Now, look, a reformist or regulationist agenda requires that we accept as a general matter that the primary focus or the primary interest is reducing suffering, and we're going to put the killing issue off. So we're going to focus on regulating use so that we can try to reduce suffering. But we're going to continue to allow use, and indeed, in certain ways, to promote use. We're going to promote use because we want to take the position that the agenda, that the movement focus ought to be on reducing suffering. I think that's wrong for some of the reasons I discussed this morning. I think that as a movement, we have bought into the notion, and it's understandable. Our movement comes from the 19th century progressive utilitarian movement that Jeremy Bentham was a part of, that John Mill was a part of. It's part of that progressive thinking that was going on that dealt with feminism, that dealt with anti-slavery, that dealt with children's rights. What our movement is comes out of that. But what that was, as I talked about this morning, was this idea that animals matter, they can suffer. And because they can suffer, they matter morally. However, they don't care that we kill them. They only care about how we treat them and how we kill them, because unlike us, they don't have an interest in their lives. I think that's wrong. I think Bentham was wrong when he said it. I think Singer's wrong when he says it. I think Tom Reagan is wrong when he says that animals have fewer opportunities for satisfaction than humans do. I think that's wrong. I think it's totally speciesist, and I think what we've done is we've linked the whole idea of the moral value of animal life with human-like cognition. And I'm telling you, I cannot see the justification for that. Is human-like cognition morally relevant? Yes, as I said this morning, it may be. There may be circumstances where differences in intelligence, differences in ability to reason, differences in abstract abilities may be relevant. But when it comes down to it, yes, if you've got somebody who's a math genius and you've got somebody who cannot do calculus and you're trying to hire a math professor, you don't hire somebody who can't do calculus or algebra or whatever. I mean, yes, then it makes sense. Math ability makes sense. In that context, it makes sense as a normative matter. But if the question is, do you take the person who's got math ability and as between the person with math ability and the person who doesn't have math ability, whom do you use as an unconsenting subject in a biomedical experiment? The answer is you don't use either of them. So this business, this focus, this fetish that we have, that we look at cognition, great apes matter more, elephants matter more, dolphins matter more, and then what happens to the fish and what happens to the chickens? The cows and the pigs, they're sort of in between, but the animals we exploit most, chickens, and sea animals, basically. We don't even think about, we have people like Peter Singer saying, I don't think it's a tragedy that we kill millions of chickens every day. I just don't see that as a tragedy on the level of the tragedy that it would be if we were killing human beings. And the answer is, yeah, that's what you say, Peter, but if you were a chicken, you'd have a different perspective. So I think, we've really got to move away from that. And I think that the whole welfare movement focuses on this to the focuses on the use notion, on the treatment notion, doesn't focus on the use notion. But when we talk about the practical problems with the welfare movement, I do not believe animal welfare does it as an empirical matter provide significantly greater protection for the interests of non-human animals? I think not. I think the difference between what the reformists want and what we've got now. It's like saying, well, you know, we think that waterboarding people in Guantanamo Bay is a bad idea, so let's put some padding on the waterboard. Or you know, let's make it better somehow. I mean, let's put padding on the waterboard, let's paint the rooms, let's play pleasant music. Would that make it better? Yeah, I guess, maybe. But is that what we should be focusing on? Certainly, the welfare reforms that are being promoted by all, and I mean all, of the large animal groups in this country, in Europe, in South America, are all basically putting padding on waterboards. I do not believe that there is any empirical evidence to indicate that animal welfare reforms are driving up costs so that demand is coming down. I have seen some claims to that effect, and if Bruce makes them today, I will take part of my 2 minutes at the end and deal with them. But I have seen some claims that some studies show that welfare reforms cause demand to go down. That's, in my judgment, complete nonsense. The study that I've seen cited, I've read it. I've read the whole thing, not just a summary of it. I've sat down with statisticians. I've gone through it. It's nonsense. It doesn't hold that at all. It basically says that that we're eating more and more animals every year, but that there's been a small decrease with pigs and maybe chickens, that the consumption of pigs and chickens, not cows, pigs and chickens haven't gone up as much. It's gone up, but not as much as one would have predicted given consumer trends. But there is no claim, nor could there be a claim. You'd have to have a lot more empirical data to be able to link any consumption patterns like that to welfare campaigns. Furthermore, when people are not eating chicken or pork, it doesn't mean they're eating tofu. It means they're shifting their purchasing choices, if they are in fact doing that. They're shifting their purchasing choices to processed foods that have pork and processed foods that have chicken. Okay? So this idea that, well, if we make the price go up, we're going to make the demand go down, the answer is, you can make the price go up, but that doesn't mean people eat tofu and broccoli. It just means they change their consumption patterns to other animal products. Okay, but there's no empirical evidence that animal welfare reforms are driving up costs. If anything, the evidence we have is that animal welfare reform actually increases production efficiency. For example, look at veal crates. Veal crates, terrible thing. Have all these veal, you know, these campaigns get veal calves out of veal crates. The reality is, if you take the veal calves out of the veal crates and put them in smaller social units, you actually reduce dramatically the veterinary cost that you incur. So it's actually cost effective. Same thing with gestation crates. If you use electronic sow feeding, you actually will reduce pig mortality. You'll increase sow productivity. And you actually increase, you make animal exploitation more economically efficient. This is not, people, this is not going to cause consumption to go down. It's not going to cause demand to go down. All this is doing is making exploitation more efficient. And the other thing that it's doing, and I think this is just devastatingly bad, is it's making everybody more comfortable. You cannot tell me that when PETA, and again, I don't mean, I have a great deal of affection for Ingrid, but the bottom line is, you cannot tell me that when PETA and Mercy for Animals and HSUS and Vegan Outreach and Compassion Over Killing and all of these organizations sign a letter expressing appreciation and support to John Mackey for his happy exploitation program at Whole Foods. They sign a letter, which was on the Whole Foods website for, I think, 2 years, okay? When you have these organizations saying, we stand behind you, we express your appreciation and support on one hand, and then on the other hand say, well, we're not encouraging people to consume that stuff, the answer is, sorry, people don't discriminate on that level. When you have all of the major organizations promoting John Mackey, when you have all of the major organizations promoting these fast food outlets, when you have groups like PETA saying that McDonald's is leading the way in the welfare of animals used in the fast food industry, you can't say that on one hand and then on the other hand say, well, we're not encouraging people to eat McDonald's. The answer is, sorry,
when PETA says something affirmative about McDonald's or about Burger King, or all of these organizations say something good about Whole Foods, you cannot tell me that is not encouraging people. I mean, you know, one of the things that Bruce and I had an exchange on, which was ended up on my website. What is that? You're going to hit that thing, right? And what does it mean?
I have another minute.
okay. And Bruce said, listen, Amnesty International, you know, they work with governments to get the torture of political prisoners reduced. Yeah, they do. I've never seen Amnesty International give an award to some dictator for lessening the torture. And I think as long as these animal groups are giving awards, which they do, they give awards to people who do this sort of thing, I think it's a disaster. Veganism, what we need is to make veganism the moral baseline. And by the way, you don't need to do that welfare. If we had a vegan movement, if we had a strong vegan movement, the animal exploitation industries would respond with the same sorts of reforms that are being promoted by these organizations. The difference would be we wouldn't be in partnership with them anymore. We wouldn't be encouraging it anymore. That would be the difference. But you'd get those animal welfare reforms. The industry's not going to stand by and do nothing. If we had a big vegan movement, you'd probably see even more dramatic gestures from industry if they really thought the demand was going to go. Anyway, see you later.
Apropos nothing before we get started, did people hear that Bill Gates bought the Seattle Times this morning? Yeah, he buys it every morning. Some people are a little slower on the uptake than others. I just want to start by saying that Gary and I agree on probably 90% of what he just said. We agree that cognition is not the issue. Capacity to suffer and valuing your life is the issue, and other animals share those basic capacities with us. We also agree that animals' lives matter, and they matter to them just like our lives matter to us. So as Will said in the introduction, I've been a vegan, abolitionist, animal rights activist for 25 years. And where Gary and I disagree is on whether we should be actively opposing welfare reforms. And he feels, as he just eloquently laid out, that they are counterproductive to helping animals and that they are basically valueless. I feel the exact opposite of that. I think both that they are meaningful for animals, and I also think that they lead us toward abolition. So, Gary, you know, a lot of people have been talking about this as a debate, and people talk about this, you know, dichotomy, welfare versus rights. And I just want to point out that that those of us who support welfare reforms, most of us are also doing, you know, mostly vegan abolitionist advocacy. We just also think that the welfare reforms are worth supporting, both for themselves, both because they're good for animals, and if these were human beings in these sorts of situations, we would not be opposing welfare reforms for them, and also because we think that it changes the playing field. It moves us from a society in which animals do have interests that don't have interests that matter to a society in which animals do have interests that matter. And that leads us toward a more compassionate society for all animals and also more vegans. So we agree, veganism should be the moral baseline. At Farm Sanctuary, we spend our lives with farm animals and we know them as individuals. We prioritize chickens, we prioritize fish, we prioritize cows and pigs. And we attempt to apply the golden rule across the species barrier. If I were this animal in a battery cage, if I were this animal in a gestation crate, if I were this animal being boiled alive, would I want people to be attempting to get me out of that crate or that cage or to not have me boiled alive? We think asking the question basically answers it. Then the second thing that we agree on is that most vegans are going to be most effective at helping animals by advocating diet change. And that's why Mercy for Animals, Vegan Outreach, Farm Sanctuary, Compassion Over Killing, the groups that Gary thinks shouldn't be supporting the welfare reforms, spend 90 to 100% of their actual budget and time advocating veganism, as Gary supports. We just also think that the welfare reforms are worth supporting. So the question before us, really, where Gary and I disagree, is whether abolitionists should oppose campaigns for improvement. And we believe that we should support them because they help animals and because they move us closer to abolition. This is Nikki, a pig in a gestation crate who is now living happily at Farm Sanctuary, who, if not for welfare reforms, would be dead, as would her babies, who are also living happily at Farm Sanctuary. Welfare reforms got her out of this cage. If you were a pig in a crate and you had the opportunity and you were not able to turn around for your entire lives, try to put yourself in Nikki's place. Try to imagine the psychological and the physical torment of not being able to turn around for your entire life. And then imagine what it would mean to you to not be forced to live in those sorts of situations. So this is crate free, and Gary showed some photos of cage free earlier. And oftentimes people who oppose welfare reforms point out that the welfare reforms don't save the animals, and that, for example, these pigs are still mutilated without pain relief. These pigs are still going to be crammed onto transport trucks and taken 36, 48 hours to slaughterhouses. These pigs are still going to be violently slaughtered at slaughterhouses. And all that is true. And I agree with Gary that we shouldn't be minimizing the suffering of animals. But I also think that if we apply the golden rule, if these were human beings in these crates, and we didn't have the opportunity to demand that they were fully liberated, but we could get them out of the crates, I don't think anybody in this room would hesitate for 1 second before saying, at the very least, we shouldn't oppose getting them out of the crates. Gary mentioned that... Gary mentioned that the reforms take some time, and that's true. Proposition 2, which passed in 2008 in California, banned gestation crates, veal crates, and battery cages. And it takes effect January 1st, 2015. It takes some time. But January 1st, 2015, gestation crates are illegal in California, veal crates are illegal in California, and barren battery cages are illegal in California. And for the millions of animals who are getting out of those crates who are still going to suffer miserably, but who are not going to suffer the physiological and psychological torment of their entire lives, unable even to take a step or turn around, you know, if you were the animals involved, that is something that you would want. Veal crate, you know, not veal crate. Is this good conditions? No. But for the animals involved, from this to this, for their entire lives, is meaningful. We slaughter about 9 billion chickens in this country every single year. Every one of these animals is still conscious when their throats are slit open. Millions of them are literally boiled alive every single year. They are snapped into metal shackles while they're still completely conscious, electric shocked, their throats are slit open. Hundreds of millions have their body cavities sliced open or their wings sliced off or a leg sliced off. And so People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has been leading the charge to try to stop 9 billion animals from being boiled alive every single year. And they have been, he put up the HSUS thing earlier, but PETA has really been the lead on controlled atmosphere killing. They would still die, obviously, but if you're the animal involved, the difference between being boiled alive and not being boiled alive when the alternative is not your freedom, or being boiled alive, the alternative is being boiled alive or not being boiled alive. At the very least, it seems to me that animal rights activists don't oppose those campaigns. Even as we, if we as individuals, the best thing for us to do is to work on veganism, which is where most of my time is put. But we don't oppose campaigns to stop animals from being boiled alive. This isn't, you know, pads on the paddles or painting the walls or playing music. This is a significant difference for the animals involved. And it strikes me as deeply speciesist. You know, if we are trying to empathize with animals, to write these changes off as insignificant. And it's worth noting, Gary did oppose Proposition 2. He is consistent. He also opposed the foie gras ban, which passed in 2004. Banning foie gras, California is the only place in the world where you can't legally buy foie gras right now. And if you think that we should at the very least not oppose boiling animals alive, if you think that at the very least we should not oppose banning foie gras, then you agree with me that it's not an either-or dichotomy. You can have both and. You can both care about the welfare of animals while they're alive and going to be killed, and want them not to be killed at all. You can support, even if you don't work for, welfare reforms at the same time that you're promoting veganism, as all of the groups that he, you know, named off absolutely prove. So imagine if these were human beings. He sort of glossed this a little bit by saying that Amnesty International doesn't thank governments that stop torturing. That's a little different from his, I mean, regardless of whether they thank or not, they certainly support welfare reforms. And the position that he is defending up here, and the position that he has been articulating for many years as eloquently as anybody could articulate it, is that the welfare reforms are counterproductive and speciesist. And I would contend very vigorously that the opposite of that is true. If we're talking about the death penalty abolitionists still don't want people to be paralyzed and suffering for the 5 minutes while the chemicals work. And not only do they support reforms that will make the death penalty painless, they actually work for reforms that will make the death penalty painless. In Saudi Arabia, they actually did support, they didn't just fight for women to be able to bicycle and drive in probably the most one of the most misogynist countries in the cultures in the world, but they also did thank the Saudi Arabian government for just this year giving women for the first time the opportunity to bicycle and drive. This is probably more toward the line of playing music as you're being tortured or whatever. But political prisoners, male visitation, protective custody. I spent about 2.5 years in jail, and so this is for peace activism before I came into the animal rights movement. And I can tell you that when we were not being given blankets or I was not being given vegan food, I shouldn't have been there in the first place for protesting against nuclear weapons. But I was really thankful to the people who were fighting to get me vegan food and fighting to get me blankets.
One more minute.
We agreed 12 minutes and I've been timing, I'm sorry. And then the last thing I want to say is I do also think that Gary is wrong. The evidence is that a culture that says we don't care at all about chickens, we don't care at all about animal welfare, is going to be a culture where it's impossible to have conversations with people about complete liberation. There are more than 1,000 studies that detail the fact that if first you get somebody to do something small, they are far more likely than to do something big. So Gary just mischaracterizes, I'm sure he read it, it must have been a while ago, the Kansas State study, which absolutely does show, and don't take my word for it, don't take his word for it, do go read it, but it does say that media attention to animal welfare issues has resulted in significant negative effects on U.S. meat demand. High-profile ballot initiatives like Proposition 2 decreased consumption. And the theory behind that is that as people are forced to think about these issues and confront these issues, they become extraordinarily uncomfortable with their own cognitive dissonance, which allows them to say, I care about animal welfare, and yet I'm paying people to torture and kill animals so that I can eat them. You have to go through the rest of the alphabet to get from A to Z. The countries and cultures that have no animal welfare regulations have no vegans and no animal rights activists. The countries and cultures that have the most animal welfare regulations have the most vegans and animal welfare activists. A legal brief from just a couple of months ago, actually less than a month ago, Proposition 2, which Gary opposed, could result in the virtual destruction of California's billion-dollar commercial egg industry. The abolitionist groups that support, as Gary well laid out, welfare reforms are, as he said, all of them, and we support them because they help animals and they move us closer to animal liberation. More resources. Thank you.
All right. So this is now your opportunity. It's your opportunity now. We have time to come up here to the microphone and ask questions of Gary and Bruce and or Bruce. And so I just want to go ahead and invite people to come on up. And obviously, when you do this, make the question very... And we also have a roaming microphone as well. Raise your hand. And make the questions brief. And we'll go ahead. We can go ahead with the first person.
Hi. Thanks so much for the wonderful talks. I really appreciate it. My name's Ann Bunner. I have a question for...
It's not work.
Oh, just stand closer. Okay. So my question is for Professor Francione. How do you reconcile veganism as a moral baseline with what we know about the psychology of persuasion and changing human behavior in terms of carrots being more effective than sticks and trying to praise movement in the right direction?
I spend every day of my life educating people, and what I've found is getting outside of the animal movement, it's much harder in the animal movement to talk about veganism and to talk about why welfare reform is counterproductive. When you're talking to ordinary people, they get it. So, I mean, the idea that somehow psychology means you can't be direct with people and say, you know, I mean, I say to people all the time, large groups, and say, look, do you think animals matter at all? If you do, then you can't eat them, wear them, or use them. That's it. It's all over. I mean, you know, now we can talk about how you can get from point A to point B. And, you know, I mean, there are some people say, I can't go vegan right away. So I say, okay, fine. Then go vegan for, you know, breakfast for a couple of weeks. You see that your arms and legs don't fall off. You don't go blind. Then you go vegan for lunch. But I never encourage people to eat cage-free eggs. I never encourage people to eat organic or drink organic milk or anything like that. And you know, so I mean, the idea that we can't get people to go from point A to point Z in a much more effective way. Look, let me tell you something. I've been doing this work now for 32 years, and I've been hearing people who support welfare reform tell me, oh, we've got to take these welfare reforms because the welfare reforms will get us to abolition. I don't see us getting closer to abolition. I see us getting closer to a culture that is comfortable with humane exploitation and that feels good about buying cage-free eggs and crate-free pork. And by the way, all of that stuff, my point is all of that stuff would happen anyway without the welfare reforms. That's a key point that I don't think Bruce addressed.
Well, I am just delighted to hear Gary say that in individual one-on-one conversations, he will encourage people to make incremental steps toward veganism. And he says he does it all the time, which I absolutely, you know, believe and am delighted to hear. Because, you know, this wasn't about whether Meatless Mondays or Vegan Before Six are good things. But in the plenary this morning, he was unkind toward those sorts of programs. And in addition to helping an awful lot of animals, I do think that on a grander scale, they do precisely what Gary does in sort of one-on-one interactions. So I think that's great.
I don't, Bruce,
First of all, I do it all the time. But secondly, the difference is I'm not going to ever say to anybody, "Hey, look, can you become vegan right away?" Yes, of course, it's extremely easy. You can spend 2 hours on the internet, learn everything you need to know about nutrition, and it's easy to go vegan. And I don't like the fact that so many of the large groups promote veganism as some sort of super Herculean thing that you can only do when you get into the Ubermensch category. But I think it really is very easy. But the difference is I'm never going to tell people that exploiting animals is normatively okay. I'm never going to tell them. I'm never going to say, well, you know, if you eat cage-free eggs, that's a good thing. I'm not going to do that because I don't believe that it's true. By the way, when you were up there speaking, I had this magazine, which I guess is put out by Mercy for Animals. It starts off with a picture of a chicken saying, "Chickens solve math problems." Well, like, who cares whether chickens solve math problems? I mean, why should whether or not we eat chickens depend on whether they solve math problems? I mean, if you want to learn algebra from a chicken,
yeah, I think you would be. It would be literally impossible to find Mercy for Animals or Compassion Over Killing or Vegan Outreach or Farm Sanctuary or any of these other abolitionist groups that also think that welfare reforms are good for animals and good for the animal rights movement ever suggesting that consuming any animal products is a good thing. So it strikes me as a straw man.
But when Mercy for Animals and Farm Sanctuary and PETA sign a letter expressing appreciation and support to John Mackey for his pioneering happy exploitation efforts, have that on the Whole Foods site, okay, and have Whole Foods advertising that all of these groups promote their happy exploitation campaign, you don't need to say anything. You really don't.
Yeah, I'm delighted to continue to talk about the Whole Foods effort. I think Whole Foods, which probably has more vegan food than any other like large chain, proves my point rather than his.
Okay, next question. Thank you, everybody. Next question.
Hi, my name is Brandon Becker. I'm an activist from North Carolina. And the debate has been set up between welfare reforms and veganism. But there's also the fact that you can work for institutional changes through abolitionist bans and advocating actual rights rather than slave welfare. So it's not just promote veganism or do welfare reforms. You can work to, instead of just modifying the conditions for chickens enslaved for their eggs, work to ban the enslavement of chickens for their eggs and work for actual rights so chickens and other animals aren't kept as property but are persons with rights. So there's that you can do in addition to veganism that doesn't compromise your message or hamper the movement towards abolition.
Okay. Very good. You want to? Okay.
Yeah, one of my heroes of the movement, Patrice Jones, was very disconcerted about this whole panel because it's set up in this sort of dichotomous either-or way, and it gives the impression that Gary and I have like a lock on the ways to see these, you know, see this movement. There are like a gazillion ways to look at this, and The first of my further resources is an article that I think is the most prescient thing I've seen on this discussion, and it's by Patrice, and it addresses the fact that this really isn't sort of a dichotomy, it's a long continuum of ways of addressing this issue.
All right, thank you, and yes.
Hello, my name is Rachel Atchison, I work with the Humane League. So I am fond of both of your works, and I'm wondering kind of what are some concrete examples of the type of activism that you both do, because I've seen, you know, a lot of Facebook posts, et cetera, but besides that, as far as the abolitionist approach, I haven't been too overwhelmed with the activism. I don't exactly understand how we're supposed to leave corporations alone and expect them to do the right thing.
Corporations. Your name's Rachel? Rachel, corporations aren't going to do the right thing. What they're going to do is what maximizes values for shareholders. That's what they're going to do. That's what corporations exist to do. And so the idea that you are going to ever make corporations behave morally, the answer is they'll only do that if it maximizes the value for their shareholders. As far as what abolitionists do,
And you say you see a lot of Facebook posts, and you said that in a somewhat derogatory way. But let me say, yes. I'm the most untechnical guy in the world. I just did my first PowerPoint presentation this morning. But I can say that I think social media is tremendous for being able to educate. It's one of the ways in which, you know, it was the case once where the only way you could talk to people about animal issues was to go through the large groups. And the large groups almost, I mean, I know he says that they spend their time promoting veganism, but the large groups spend a huge amount of time and a huge amount of their resources promoting these welfare campaigns. And there's always been a lot of hostility against people who are critical of those campaigns. One of the things that's happened with social media is the opportunity costs of communication have now dropped dramatically so that we can form communities. We can communicate with each other. We don't need the large groups anymore, number one. Number two, if you think about what we have done in, I would say, the past 6 or 7 years in terms of grassroots groups forming in countries all around the world that are promoting veganism as a moral baseline, and we haven't done it with the how many hundreds of millions of dollars that the large organizations have. HSUS sits on top of what? $250 million. PETA takes in what? $30, $40, $50 million. I don't know what Farm Sanctuary takes in. All of that money, we don't have any of it. And what we've done in 5 or 6 or 7 years in terms of getting people focused on the idea that veganism is the moral baseline, I'm proud of that.
And how, can you elaborate on how?
They do it in all sorts of different ways. I mean, I was in Spain, for example, and I saw there were groups in Spain that were going to on market days, and they were setting up, and they had vegan literature, and they had samples of vegan food because people think that vegans eat styrofoam or whatever, and that they don't, you know, and people have samples of vegan food. They engage people because, you see, I really do think, to me, Michael Vick is the gift that keeps on giving. Because Michael Vick, everybody hates Michael Vick. Because why? Because he engaged in the exploitation of animals, and the best justification he had was that it brought him pleasure. I would suggest that's the only justification we have for eating animal products. And I think when I talk to 300 people, 300 kids in a college, and I discuss Michael Vick with them, and I get 60 people writing to me saying, you've got me thinking, I'm going vegan. My view is bang for bang, you know, buck for buck, they get a big bang from that. I'll keep doing it.
And Bruce, your examples of activism?
Sorry to drag this cord over you, Gary.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, all of the groups that Gary disclaims do tremendous vegan abolitionist advocacy. Farm Sanctuary produced a video last year called What Came Before, which introduces you to three of Farm Sanctuary's residents and then goes through what happens to farm animals, the fact that they're individuals with personalities who, for the same reason you wouldn't eat a dog or a cat, shouldn't be eating a chicken or a fish or a pig. It does have fish information in there as well. More than 1 million people have seen it in the last 10 months. We also have a leaflet called Something Better that about 600,000 people have passed out. If you look at Farm Sanctuary's website or Mercy for Animals or Compassion Over Killing or Vegan Outreach, you'll see that the vast majority of what all of these groups do is abolitionist. And then I personally, in addition to working for Farm Sanctuary, my wife and I have, I think, about 50 vegan starter kit stands around Washington, D.C. So if you saw one of the vegan starter kit stands, those are the stands that we manage, which, again, are also abolitionist.
Thank you for that question. I'd like to go to over here to this side of the room.
Thank you. Great talk. I agree with the idea that change happens incrementally, as supported by the studies that you put up there and as supported by anecdotal evidence that I'm sure we all have experienced ourselves. At the same time, I'm concerned, and I agree with Gary that basically to say, it's okay to have happy meat or to have letters that you pointed out, it could be interpreted by the general public as condoning that eating meat is okay, and I'm not so bad, and it actually decreases the guilt, which I think the guilt can be a very powerful factor or a force in getting people to change. So the question is that I think, well, the way I see it is that in order to get a vegan nation, we're going to have to convince the consumers, not the corporations, and make it desirable for consumers, not corporations, to eat vegan. So it seems like there's two strategies. There's a strategy for corporations and there's a strategy for consumers. And it seems like there's no disagreement here that we should be marketing to consumers that a vegan diet is the best way. I guess the question, it seems like, is there's a disagreement about how we really will market to the organizations. How do we send a message to corporations saying, yes, get meat off the you know, menu, but until you do that, at least make it, you know, at least make it less suffering and not have the consumers get confused in that message.
Is that
I think
possible?
That's a question.
That's a great, what's your name?
Sandeep.
Sandeep. That's a great observation, and I think that, you know, you're right. The welfarist approach is to try to focus on supply and to say that what we want to do is make the supply of, we want to make the supply of animal products have less suffering. Whereas the rights or abolitionist approach is to try to sort of hit demand. I mean, the bottom line is, unless we affect demand, unless we persuade people that this is not a morally acceptable choice to make, and you don't do that, by the way, there tends to be sort of a straw man thing set up that if you take an abolitionist, anti-regulationist perspective, that you're basically criticizing people and attacking them and whatnot. And the answer is no. There are all sorts of great, creative, nonviolent ways of educating people about veganism. But ultimately, if you want a vegan nation, you got to hit the demand. You got to get people to stop demanding the product. Because you're always going to be limited, Sandeep, at the supply level by the economics of the supply. You can have Proposition 2, and again, Bruce's characterization of my position on Proposition 2 was, and I understand why he's doing that for this purpose, this was somewhat simplistic. My point is, it really doesn't matter what you do in California, because if there's a demand for the lower welfare products, they'll come in from New Mexico, from Arizona, from Oregon, et cetera. So it doesn't really matter in the end. Which is why, by the way, they're trying to get legislation which is going to if there's a national egg standard, which HSUS is now promoting and some of these other groups, I think like Farm Sanctuary, are supporting it, that it will be a national standard and every state will have to abide by it. They realize that that's what they've got to do to make even the small improvement of the enriched cage be viable as a national strategy. I mean, this is so little. It's so little. And again, it's a zero-sum game. Every minute of time we take, every cent of resources that we spend on promoting people, or on advising people or encouraging people to eat happy this and happy that, is a minute of time less and a cent of resource less that we use to persuade people that veganism is the only rational response to animal exploitation.
If you Google Gary Francione and Proposition 2, the first thing that comes up is Gary Francione telling people to oppose it. So he didn't. If he had said this will not do any good, that would have been great. But he told people to oppose it, and people did come out and oppose it. The second thing, first hit, is Gary, somebody saying, what's your position on Proposition 2? You should oppose it, it's counterproductive, exactly what he said this morning in the plenary. The second thing is that actually, no, lower welfare eggs will not be coming into California with the passage of Proposition 2, because they also passed a law saying lower welfare, you have to meet the California standard for any eggs to come in. So that's just, you know, both of those statements are factually inaccurate. And as is the continued straw man of, I don't want to tell people to eat happy this or happy that. None of the many abolitionist groups who think welfare reforms are helpful for the animals involved, and if these were human beings suffering like this, we wouldn't be opposing these reforms. And none of the abolitionist groups who think that they help us move toward abolitionism because it changes the playing field, none of those groups does what Gary keeps disclaiming and implying that we do. You know, we just don't.
Okay, we have time for just a few more questions. Okay, go ahead.
I don't think I'll be booed out of the room if I say that both of you, while you may, welfareism and abolitionism have different points of view, we do have, both of you have shown that you have your eye on the prize, whether it be different approaches, we all want to, some future total exploitation to take place. I deal with the public constantly, and I just, what I need is some fodder for my arguments. With the welfareism, what I hear is, when they see the stamp, the HSUS stamp, that it will stop people in their progression, that they'll become comfortable and not go any further. And then what I hear from the abolitionist point is, are we ignoring their horrible current conditions and just focusing on total abolition? Is that ambiguous, or do you understand what I'm saying? Okay.
Great. Thank you. You want to, I think we can go to the next question, probably. Yeah. Wait, unless you.
Yes, people, when they'll ask me, with welfareism, are we just making them comfortable and then they're going to stop and not go any further? And with abolitionism, are they going to ignore the horrible conditions now and just focus on total abolitionism? And I don't know how to answer. I get that constantly through my work, and I don't know how to answer those questions.
If they decide, if you're asking, at least me, about whether they're going to ignore the current hideous conditions if they focus on abolition. And the answer is, if you follow the reforms that the large groups promote, it's not going to be any better, number one. Number two, again, an issue that Bruce doesn't seem to want to deal with, is these reforms will happen even if these large groups are not promoting them, because they are cost effective. Crate-free pork is cost-effective. Getting rid of veal crates is cost-effective. It's what, I mean, the industry and these organizations have this interesting sort of drama going on. The organizations identify some inefficient, economically inefficient practice. The corporations will resist for a while because they have to impose an opportunity cost on the animal people to make sure that they have to impose opportunity costs. And then eventually the change is made, and the organizations say, oh, industry's great, and the industries say, oh, we really care about animal welfare. And miraculously, Bruce seems to think that this is not affecting how the public perceives animal products. I mean, look, I have one question I would love to ask you. If these labels are not making, if things like certified humane raised and handled, or the humane choice, or the five-step animal welfare program, if these things don't work, if these things aren't encouraging people to continue to consume animal products, can you tell me why, as a matter of fundamental capitalism 101, these corporations are gravitating towards these things? If they don't work, why? Why is that?
But Bruce, I really wanted to know.
So the articles that I list there go into the psychology of this issue in detail. I wish I shared Gary's confidence that all of the meat eaters were just waiting for welfare, like they would otherwise go vegan if not for the welfare reforms. But the welfare reforms are all in the last 5 to 10 years, which is also the first time we've seen significant drops in meat consumption. These labels... So as probably most people in this room know, the Animal Welfare Act exempts farm animals altogether. The Humane Slaughter Act exempts birds, who are 98.5% of slaughtered animals. So we have not had any welfare reforms for farm animals until a decade ago. It was the very first one, was Florida with the gestation crate ban. And if you look at the precipitous drop, more than 1 billion fewer animals were eaten last year than were eaten 7 years ago. It tracks identically with the gestation crate bans, as well as with the rise of these humane labels. Now, I also recoil at the humane labels. The idea of certified humane on an animal corpse is revolting, and it's wrong. And I would never suggest that somebody look for it, and I would never suggest that somebody buy it. But the psychology is absolutely overwhelming that the people who go from eating the worst abused animals to animals with the certified humane or American humane or whatever else on the package, they weren't gonna otherwise go vegan. They're supporting less abuse rather than more abuse. And now that they've done something, we have more than 1,000 psychological studies that say that the consistency principle can kick in and it will be far easier to talk to them about veganism. Now that they've said, I've made a decision on behalf of chickens, and then we say, well, why did you do that? You know, they, in order to be consistent, have to stop paying people to slice chickens' throats open. So I just fundamentally and completely disagree with the idea that people are going to go from not giving, not caring at all, to that going, I mean, a lot of people do, and that's mostly what we support, but when people go to certified humane or they go to one of these other labels, they're far more likely to take the next step. And it wasn't they were otherwise going to go vegan, it's they are now far more likely to go vegan.
Okay, so this, I guess, unfortunately, pardon me? In the back?
No, not that one.
Oh, I see.
Come on.
You were over there, now you're over here. Okay, go ahead, we'll have one more. Let's wait.
Working now? Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Great, I had a question I wanted to direct to Bruce. So you mentioned earlier in the University of Kansas study done by some agricultural economists, you didn't mention this point, but they found that the number of farm animals that would have suffered in the past 10 years were it not for media attention to animal welfare issues, be it legislation or other animal welfare issues, that there would have been 10 billion additional animals that would have suffered and been killed in these farms over the past 10 years if not for these welfare advances. So along those lines, I had, here's my question to you, I guess point that I would love your thoughts on. There's a great organization, they're not tabling this weekend, but they're called Humane Research Council, that like those agriculture economists, they say, you know, rather than look at this as a philosophical question, let's just look at the data of, you know, what happens and what causes it. And they had a really interesting study they conducted a few years ago that, among other things, found that those who eat, you know, so-called humane meat or what they believe to be humane meat, free-range eggs, cage-free eggs, so on and so forth, the people who eat, quote-unquote, humane meat are more likely to go vegetarian or go vegan than the rest of the public. This would seem to contradict a lot of what we've heard from Mr. Francione, but I would love to hear your thoughts on those points.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true and more eloquently stated than my attempt to say basically the same thing a moment ago, but if people want to email for the articles, don't take Gary's word for it, don't take my word for it. The Kansas State study is extraordinarily eloquent, I mean, extraordinarily well done. It's peer-reviewed, and it explains, certainly it was convincing to me, that the welfare reforms move us toward fewer animals being consumed at all. And we've only in the last 5 or 6 years seen farm animal welfare put onto people's moral map. And we've also only seen a decrease, you know, of a billion animals a year, a decrease in animal consumption over these last 5 or 6 years. And there are many articles written on this issue. I've never seen one written in the other direction. When that study came out in 2010, Gary said, this is a crap study, and I'm going to be publishing something explaining why it's a crap study, and we just had a quick exchange. He worked with a statistician, and I guess, you know, they think it's a crap study, but the statistician wasn't able to write the piece yet. But, oh, I'm sorry, that's what I thought. Okay, I'll give you, that's what I thought you said. But yeah, no, that is absolutely right. But the other thing I want to say is, for people who apply the golden rule across the species barrier, for people who care about animals as individuals, the idea that it would even be a strong argument that these animals suffering more is somehow, like, we would not support causing these animals to suffer less because it makes our end goal harder. I can't even begin to imagine anybody in any human rights movement making that sort of an argument. It strikes me as deeply speciesist.
Go read the Kansas State study. Read it. It's in the Journal of Agricultural Economics, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Read the study. It does not state, it is astonishing to me, actually, when I hear the characterization of this, and I believe it was something that Farm Sanctuary put out about that study. It does not state that at all. Read it. Go read it yourself, okay? And keep in mind that go read the study. And if you think what it's saying is that there's a causal relationship, or that they are attributing a causal relationship to animal welfare reform and decrease in consumption, I suggest call me. Call me at my office at Rutgers and let's talk, because I can assure you that's not what that study says. Also, this idea that what I'm saying is we should take people who don't give a damn and they're going to become vegan because we're going to tell them about the abolitionist theory. No, that's not what I'm saying. There's always going to be people who don't give a damn, okay? And you know what? There's a lot of people out there who do give a damn. And what I'm concerned about is we're talking to people who do give a damn, and we're giving them a moral pass. We're sort of putting an imprimatur of the animal organizations and saying, you can discharge your moral obligations by eating cage-free eggs or eating happy meat or drinking organic milk. We're giving them a moral pass. It's not the people who don't care I'm concerned about. You know what? The people who don't care are never going to buy that stuff. Just think about it for a second, common sense. If you don't really care, then why are you going to buy cage-free eggs? By definition, you don't care. So if you don't care, you don't care. What I'm concerned about is the people who do care, the people who do get angry at Michael Vick, the people who do have companion animals that they regard as members of their family. Those people care. And I think we're making a very, very serious mistake by letting them off the hook and saying to them, you can discharge your obligations to non-human animals by eating happy. You can go to Whole Foods. I really think that's a very, 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 very bad idea. And I also want to say this business that these groups have been, the past 5 years, and now these groups are sort of changing the world. The bottom line, people, look at history. I realize that, the age in which we live in, people don't take a look at what's happened beyond last week. But you know what? We've had animal welfare reform now at some periods of time very strong for 200 years. We're exploiting more animals in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. If you think this is working, I respectfully disagree.
Yeah, no, once again, Gary and I agree that we shouldn't be promoting happy meat and that veganism should be the moral baseline. Mercy for animals, compassion for killing, Farm Sanctuary. We all agree that veganism should be the moral baseline. But I would just point out again that animal welfare with regard to dogs and cats is very different than animal welfare with regard to other animals. And we still have absolutely no legal protection whatsoever for fish. And we still have absolutely no legal protection whatsoever for chickens, and those are the two animals who are most exploited. So the idea of saying we've had animal welfare around for hundreds of years, for farm animals, we've had some teeny modicum of animal welfare going back to 2002, and it really only started kicking off 5 or 6 years ago, which is also when we started to see the decline in the overall consumption of animals.
Bruce. You say that you support veganism, and I'm sure that you are a vegan, but you also, I have read, since you want to talk to me about my views on Proposition 2, and please, go read my essays on Proposition 2. You have described the idea of being a consistent vegan as purist and as fanatical. Now, my view basically is, yes, I am vegan. I will not, I'm a label reader. I read, I will not put anything in my mouth that I don't know whether, if there's any animal product. And if I'm in a restaurant and I can't get something vegan or something I'm reasonably certain is vegan, I don't eat. But you talk about the purest approach, and I believe, actually, didn't you join in with Peter in that essay in which you talked about veganism being fanatical?
Was, you should ask, Gary.
I asked.
My quote, Gary's interpretation,
to my quote.
No, that's not the quote I'm talking about. That's not the quote I'm talking about.
So Gary brought up this quote in our back and forth, which you can go to his website, Abolitionist Online. And if you go to Abolitionist Online and you read my exchange with Gary, he linked to this as his example of my calling veganism whatever a cultural...
But that was your essay on personal purity. It was your essay on personal
And that's
purity.
That's the only thing in it in which I say something about a cultural fad. And veganism shouldn't just be about us. Veganism should be about helping animals. And if we turn veganism into this personal level 5 purity vegan, you know, test, and it's, you know, all about this, I'm more vegan than you're vegan, that's the essay. And I encourage you to read the essay. I stand by everything that I said. But Gary links to the essay, and he characterizes it in exactly the way he just characterized it. And this is the quote. I think it's pretty mischaracterized.
Read Bruce's essay. Read his essay, and I think it's Go Veg, isn't it? Is it Go Veg? Yeah, it's linked. I link to the actual essay. Read his essay and what he says about personal purity and the approach that he takes. I mean, my view is basically, look, I object to all sorts of things. I'm a purist or an absolutist when it comes to child pornography. I mean, it's not just a little bit, or it's not just, it's a matter of it's wrong, it's excluded. This idea that we should not treat veganism the same way, this idea that, well, you know, I believe the example he gave, I don't have the essay in front of me, but I believe the example he gave is, what happens if you're in a restaurant and somebody brings you the food and there's some animal product in the food?
Can I just announce that other session that started going on just so people know? I'm sorry, real fast. I just want to let everyone know there's two kind of guerrilla sessions going on right now. Guerrilla as in EU, not OR. One of them is in Birch Room. It's about gender relations in our movement, and it's already started 10 minutes ago. Birch is down.
Yeah, it's the one about sexual abuse in the movement. So anybody who's interested in, you know, this topic, that please come down, and it's going to be a sort of a private session. Well, you know, a safe
space. It's a safe space, basically. It's down the hall past Arbor's in Birch Room. Also, right across the hall in Beach Room, there's a session about the activities going on in Latin America and in Mexico by vegan abolitionists. So those are going on, and we're going to have to end this by 2 so that we can turn this room back into a session room.
And one other quick announcement. The lady who found a blue bag with someone's personal effects, please bring it to the front. The lady is waiting for it right here.
All right. I think, you know, this has been fantastic. We're in a really critical time. We'll have, this is the very last question.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And then we'll have the closing statements. Thank you.
Yeah, I was afraid I wouldn't be able to say, ask this. This is something I've had to reluctantly change my opinion on over the years, but not for any of the reasons that have been stated here. When people watch all the factory farming videos, the first question they immediately ask is, are these isolated incidents, or is this the standard industry practice? And the message that's being sent by all the welfare campaigns, unfortunately, is that these are isolated incidents, isolated to a specific practice, or isolated to a specific company, when nothing can be further from the truth. There are many people who reject the animal rights philosophy, but when you explain to them that in order to find meat from the types of places that you find are ethically acceptable would require far more effort than going vegan, many people will do precisely that, or very close to it. There's even many hunters who will still eat the animals they kill themselves, but they absolutely refuse to buy any meat from any store, grocery store, any restaurant, on the grounds that they refuse to eat animals that they, unless they can be guaranteed that they were not tortured. Yet all those humane labels are guaranteeing that very thing when nothing can be further from the truth. The problem is not just that we're telling people that it's okay to eat happy meat. We're telling people it's okay to eat factory farm meat. We're not just condoning eating animals in principle. We're advocating that it's okay to torture them too. We are not, you know, elevating them to the next level. We're actually sinking far below the social norms that have existed in our society since long before the dawn of recorded civilization. The thing you're putting this is acceptable label, that would have been condemned by every major religion, you know, for the past 1,000 years.
Thank you. All right. You want to I think we can have the closing.
Just real quick, veganism is not a diet. It's the idea in life and way of living that animals are not ours to use for any purpose, not just diet. please stop referring to it as a diet, both of you, and everyone else in this room. Thank you.
Good point. Very good point.
I understand what you're saying, but the reality is, as long as we're eating them, nothing else changes, and once we stop eating them, everything changes. Have you ever met anybody who... No, wait. Have you ever met anybody? I mean, and I'm asking this sincerely. Have you ever met anybody who started off like, you know, who got it without changing diet? I agree with you. Veganism means not eating, wearing, or using animals. I agree with you. That's how I try. But to say that there's no such thing as a vegan diet is simply wrong. If that were true, then it would make no sense to go into a restaurant and say, do you have vegan food? No, I'm with you. All I'm saying is, until we get people to focus on what they stick in their mouth three times a day, we're never gonna really, I mean, once you get them to adopt a vegan diet, everything changes. Until you get them to adopt a vegan diet, nothing changes.
All right. Okay. So I want to thank all of you.
One thing.
We have
labeling, just to finish it. I fully understand both positions, and I think we're going into the very devilish details. And hair splitting is not going to help. What I would like to suggest is that the so-called big organizations with the humane labeling, I mean, Bruce, great respect for you, for both. If you just agreed on one thing, that the names of these organizations are not going to be mentioned on the labels, let the corporations do whatever they want, what the hell they want. It shouldn't be our business to manage their business policies. They have enough professionals doing that. We should concentrate on our message and forget about what the hell they're doing.
Okay. All right, thank you. And we're going to now, this is really obviously a critical issue, and we'll have the closing statements by the two wonderful people we have here. So remind me who goes. Let's see. Right. Bruce and then Gary. Yeah, Bruce is first.
This was fun. Wasn't this fun? Yeah. I can't remember who it was, but somebody was saying that when we can get this passionate about areas that where we disagree, when we agree so thoroughly on some basic issues. I mean, everybody in this room is opposed to animal exploitation. Everybody in this room agrees with veganism as the moral baseline. You know, that puts us in a minority in this country, and it's really exciting. Vic said that this is Vic from Vegan Outreach was on a panel with me yesterday, and he said this is such a phenomenal, highly charged, wonderful conference of beautiful people doing beautiful things. And I couldn't agree more. It's really just an honor and a pleasure to be here with all of you. So thank you for that. I also just want to say again that there are just a wide variety of ways of looking at this issue. And it is not the case that Gary and I encapsulate, you know, every possible perspective on the issue of abolitionism or on the issue of welfare. Where we do disagree is that I think that the welfare reforms, A, you know, they help the individual animals involved, and if we were those animals, we would want both the welfare reforms and the abolitionist campaigns. And I also think that B, as we change society to cause them to care more about farm animals and to codify that some of the worst abuses are not okay, that changes the playing field, and it leads to more vegans, and it leads to more animal liberation. If you were a chicken, one of the 9 billion chickens this year who's going to be fully conscious when your throat is slit open, or one of the hundreds of millions who are boiled alive, or if you were a pig in a gestation crate, or a hen in a cage, or a foie gras duck, you know, you would want people who were not making some sort of calculation about whether it would make Americans feel better about eating meat. You know, we would never use human beings as pawns in this same way where we say, I'm not going to, you know, I am going to oppose getting hens out of cages or banning foie gras, because that's going to make Americans feel comfortable eating meat. There is no situation in which a human rights activist would say, no, I'm going to oppose that reform because it's going to, you know, somehow codify the overall suffering or abuse. For the simple reasons that we care about animals as individuals, we should be at the very least not opposing and really supporting efforts to get rid of the worst abuses. And we really have to characterize the abuses as, like, you know, listening to music or painting the walls rather than the very real decrease in suffering that they represent in order to try to disparage them. And then secondly, you know, this one is hard to sum up when you're given, you know, 12 minutes and 2 minutes, but I do recommend to you the articles that I'm going to put up after this slide, because they go a lot more in depth into the psychology that justifies Matt Ball's quote from Vegan Outreach. And it's worth noting, Matt puts 100% of his effort into vegan abolitionist campaigns. And Vegan Outreach puts 100% of their efforts into abolitionist vegan campaigns. But they also support the welfare campaigns in theory, and, you know, will post something on their website. And that's because the evidence, when you look at it, shows that reforms draw attention of non-vegetarians to the issue, persuading many to reconsider their ethics and actions. Animal groups then use these victories to gain visibility and to push for further reforms. In this way, welfare measures are a slippery slope toward abolition, not away from it. And again, I would encourage you, look at the countries that have absolutely no welfare reforms at all, and there's no animal rights movement and no vegans. Look at the countries. Well, even if it's wrong, it's not a lie. This is my Barack Obama moment where, was it Steve King who screamed liar? So this is, well, but I mean, see, this is one of the things that Patrice was so concerned about, this idea that we have to, like, scream at one another and challenge one another's, you know, honesty and integrity. Like, I really appreciated that Gary got up and said, I don't challenge Bruce's integrity. I don't think he's making things up. You know, I don't think he's lying, I think he's wrong. So even if I'm wrong, and I've read a fair amount about it, and there's a fair amount written about it, I mean, even if I'm wrong, I assure you, I mean, you don't have to believe me, but I assure you I'm not lying. So, hopefully we can at least... The groups that support these welfare reforms are doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it because they've looked at all of the evidence that exists, they fully considered the evidence, they fully considered the arguments, and they think that it helps the animals involved to support the welfare reforms, and it moves us closer toward abolition and converts more people to veganism. And that's why we, you know, disagree with Gary and think that at the very least, even if all of your activism is veganism, at the very least, don't oppose the welfare reforms. They're good for animals and good for liberation. Thank you.
I think we've got to change the paradigm, and I think, I mean, we really have to rethink and reconceptualize how we think about non-human animals, and we're never going to do that as long as we're supporting welfare reform. It's never going to happen. I mean, Bruce talks about, and I have a lot of affection for Bruce. I mean, he's one of the very few people in the movement who has been involved in human rights issues before, and I respect that. I mean, you know, he has a progressive position, and I respect that. But I think he's just dead wrong on this. This idea that, well, we, you know, the issue is not do we promote them, but should we not oppose them? The answer is, who's promoting them? I mean, it's not it's these large organizations are promoting these things. They're not just falling out of the sky, and then I say, well, we should oppose them. I mean, no, it's the organizations are going out and doing huge amounts of fundraising, collecting huge amounts of money, which they're using on these welfare reform campaigns. So it's not just a question of, well, do we just not oppose them? It's a question of, no, should we promote them? Should you support them? Should you be giving money to organizations that promote these things? That's the fundamental question. this idea. He says, well, you know, but we've got to do this because animals, you know, what about the animals suffering now? I've been hearing about the animals suffering now for a long time, and I'm telling you, the realities, again, look at the economics of it. These things are going to happen anyway. So when he says, if you're one of the 9 billion chickens that's going to, you know, going to have his or her throat cut, the answer is, you know what? If you are the most horrible human being on the planet Earth and you start a chicken slaughtering plant tomorrow, you would be out of your mind to use electrical stunning because controlled atmosphere killing is much more cost effective. So what's going to happen is controlled atmosphere killing, it's already becoming very, very popular in industry because as equipment gets older and gets expensed out for tax purposes, when it gets replaced, it's getting replaced with controlled atmosphere killing. Same thing with the gestation crate. Same thing with the veal crate. He talks about foie gras. All right, great. Yes, I did. I thought that was an idiotic campaign. I still believe it's an idiotic campaign. I don't believe there is any difference between foie gras and any of the other animal products that we eat. And I think this idea that what we do is we say, oh, you're a good person, you're a moral person, you're not eating foie gras. The answer is, oh, but you're eating a hamburger or you're eating, you know, you're eating some other animal product. So, I mean, yeah, I do think that that's a crazy, just like I think, I've always thought the anti-fur thing was a misogynistic, but there ain't no difference between fur and leather and wool and silk and all that sort of stuff, and that's why I would never participate in that either. It's all the same thing. There's nothing about fur that makes it worse than leather or wool. If you've ever seen how wool's produced, it's pretty violent. So this idea that, well, you know, I mean, I've always thought the reason why we have anti-fur campaigns is because if you walk up to a man wearing a leather coat and say some of the things that animal people will say to women wearing fur, you will have your teeth removed. And so I've always thought that that was a primary reason why we didn't include leather. I really think, in the end, I mean, this is not about, again, this is not about whether or not we oppose something. It's a question of whether we support it. Are we going to support welfare reform? It is my view that that welfare reform is, that the welfare reforms that they're encouraging will happen anyway. And if we had a vision, if we had a vision of nonviolence, of animal rights, and we objected to animal use and didn't participate in any of this happy exploitation, and we had a movement that was built around veganism, you think industry's just going to sit there and say, we ain't going to do anything, we're going to let them continue to suffer? No. What they're going to do is engage in the cost-effective reforms that they're engaging in now because it's economically good for them to do. We're going to have exactly the same situation. The difference is going to be we're not going to have animal groups telling the public that John Mackey's doing a great job with his animal compassionate program. We're not going to have animal people saying McDonald's is leading the way in animal welfare. We're not going to have people putting an imprimatur, a stamp of approval, on animal exploitation. We're not going to have those partnerships. But if you think that we're not going to have the reforms, we'll have them. We'll have the I think, relatively minor reforms that, I mean, the difference between cage-free eggs and conventional battery eggs is that the animals are in a larger cage. That's all. A cage-free situation is torture. And the idea that we have animal people promoting cage-free eggs is just, in my judgment, tragic. Again, remember, and one thing I want to leave you with, and that is this. We've all got limited time. We've all got limited resources. So you got to make a decision. Like, let's assume that this afternoon's your last afternoon on Earth. Do you want to spend it talking to a bunch of people about eating cage-free eggs, or do you want to spend it talking to people about why they shouldn't be eating animal products at all? In both cases, you're not going to convert everybody, okay? But what message do you want to send out? My view is if you believe in animal rights, you never, ever, ever, ever send out the message that animal exploitation can ever be morally acceptable. Peace. Thank you very much.
All right, let's give a hand. Bruce and Gary, thank you very much. All right, so let's go forth. I know we went really long. It was a great session. Thank you all, and this is a critical issue. Let's keep going and moving forward on it. Thank you.